come join the conversation, the show that you've been wanting. Keep it real with no filter, weekly we share discussions. WWSD, interviewing creative guests, talking the creative process and sharing all the influences from TV and film. Emmy nominated and winning, yeah, they coming through. Actors and comedians too, directors and writers, way more than a few. Masters of their craft, yes, tune in, you gotta see. This the podcast that you need, WWSD.
Welcome to the WWSD podcast. Weekly, we share discussions with interesting and creative people. I'm your host, Josh, and as always, I'm joined by my buddy and co-host, Seamus. How's it going, Seamus?
Going great, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Who do we have on tonight?
Tonight, we have a very, very special guest. We are joined by David Scott Holloway, a photographer and filmmaker. David has worked with Anthony Bourdain on Parts Unknown and some of my all-time favorite shows, such as Impractical Jokers, Man vs. Food, plus so much more. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on our podcast tonight. How are you doing, David?
I'm doing good, man. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks a lot for coming on.
That's funny that you said Impractical Jokers was the one. So many other shows.
Your list is so impressive. I was like, these are like, yeah, like all the stuff you've done with CNN and stuff. Like, you actually have a really awesome resume. I was blown away by the amount of stuff you actually worked on. It's very, very, very impressive career.
I'm just getting started, bro.
Yeah. But speaking of just getting started, like, how'd you get into photography? Did you go to school for photography?
No. I'm just another failed skateboarder.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's a ton of them. And now in New York City, it's really obvious. You meet all these skateboarders and there's like always like five skateboarders and they've always got a filmer. And that's like a thing now. It's their friend who just knows that he's not actually going to make it as a skateboarder. I was like way ahead of all those dudes, like 25 years ahead of them, but for no good reason was always convinced that I was still going to be a skateboarder. This is going to work out. This is photo thing is just because I actually don't know what it's for.
Have you done any skateboarding? I don't think I saw any skateboarding stuff on your IMDb or anything.
No, not really. Like I had a million years ago, I like lucked into shooting a bunch of stuff for Thrasher. Early on, you didn't really make any money. I would get these checks for $30 a piece. Yeah, it was awesome. But like a big deal for me, mostly what that did was some of the guys that I knew, it benefited them. And so they're like, yeah, David should be with us because we're going to have pictures. But now everyone knows, everyone does that. Even here, it's like kind of funny. Like I'll see some dudes. One thing that's really fun during the summer is like, there'll be like construction sites. And here, roads are fucking terrible. And these guys will have like giant, like inch thick steel sheets, like iron sheets. I don't even know what they are. They're metal. And they use them. They put them down over the holes so the cars go over them. But there'll be big stacks of them. And dudes will just spend all day riding these construction sites. And it's awesome. You know, they'll have their little crew there and they'll be filming. And you'll just like roll up, go to shoot something on my phone of it. And then the guy's like, oh yeah, yeah, no, you can't shoot that. And it's like, are you kidding me, dude? You're on the street in New York City. You're not going to tell me I can't shoot some of my own neighborhood. This is crazy. They're trying to protect their thing. The guy's like, you got that. Like, how am I going to sell this? When the thing was, I was like, man, I'm not calling up his sponsors and going, hey, you guys want to give me $50 for this video clip I just shot with my phone? Nuts. But man, skateboarders are the best.
You still skate at all?
I don't really.
I see the decks behind you. Yeah.
So this is actually the one that I want to put together for my son.
Okay.
Is he skating now?
No, he has no interest. No interest.
Really? Oh man, it's heartbreaking.
It is. I have this friend Lars. He's German. He was a competitive swimmer his whole life, and he owns like a swimming company here in town. And all of his friends are Olympians. In California, he was the swim captain of the swim and dive team for University of Southern California when he was in college. He's like, you know, just a big, goofy German guy, but he really loves like skateboarding and punk rock. Mm-hmm. And so now he's like got this like awesome business and whatever. And so our kids were in school together and he was always just like, I'm going to do a terrible German accent. We should just... Yeah, we dropped the boys at school and we should go straight to the skate park. Yeah, all right, awesome. And so we would go down there and there's like two other people down there at like 8:30 in the morning after we drop the kids off. And it's amazing. But skateboarding now is you go down there and you like ride around for a little bit. And then the first time I slam, I'm like done. I'm like, okay, I damaged my psoas. You guys know what psoas is?
No, I don't know what that is.
Is that your like hip flexor?
Yeah, it's like the inside part of your hip flexor in okay. your like in your crotch. And only women know about it, I think. Because like I mention it to other women, like, oh yeah, hip flexor, that's like a really difficult. I can show you some stretches you can do for anything. But I damaged it like before COVID. And so then it's like I'm going to physical therapy and I'm like doing all this stuff and it's awesome, but it's a lot of work and it's like really painful. Like you kind of forget that, like, okay, it's totally fine. But then other like I'd be like walking down the street and I'd see people that are like, are you okay? What do you mean? They're like, oh, you're limping pretty bad. I was like, really? Oh, I didn't even notice. But now when COVID happened, like I was working on a show and I was traveling for almost 3 months before quarantine started here. And then I had this like whole plan. I had all of, took a foam roller with me. I have all these videos from my physical therapist, all the exercises I'm supposed to be doing. And I have this friend, Johnny Colt. He was in the Black Crows and he was in a bunch of bands, but his last band that he was in was Lynyrd Skynyrd and went on tour. And then he was just posting videos like every night of him working out with like an elevation mask in his hotel room. I would never want to stay in any hotel room that he stayed in because he's like there in the carpet working out, just sweat pouring off of him. Like rooms had to have smelled terrible. But I was just like, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be traveling for this thing. I'm going to work out my hotel room every day. It's going to be incredible. It's going to be awesome. And then that worked for like 2 weeks. And then I got COVID in Italy. But we didn't really know that I had COVID because the medical crew on the team was like, there were two of us that got sick and like, no, you guys are fine. You just have the flu. You need to take some emergency. We're not anywhere near those guys and nothing's wrong. Okay, fine. So then the next week we're in Switzerland. We're like up in the Alps and they're like, no, the reason you can't breathe is because we're at altitude and you've been trekking through the snow all day. You guys are fine. You need to have some emergency and you need to go to sleep tonight. It's like, oh, Jesus Christ. But then at the end of the show, you know, 10 weeks later, 12 weeks later, I was fine. I was like tired still all the time. But when we get shut down and sent back, everyone else goes to LA and I come back to New York and like 30 people on the crew tested positive for COVID. And they're like, oh, we thought we were ahead of it all. And really, we're just dragging it across Europe.
Super spreading it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, nobody thought you had COVID. You're just giving it to everybody.
Yeah. It was ridiculous. But now, like now that'd be a ridiculous liability. Can you imagine just like a giant production crew, like hauling across Europe, just
everyone coughing on each other. People, and, so circle back around. So you into photography for skateboarding. You wanted to take photos of your buddies doing tricks and stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, what happened was, I think it's happened to a ton of people. I realized that this kind of opened the door to everything. Everything like that I'm a little bit interested in. I'm super curious about everything. I want to do everything. I want to like stick my nose in everything. And, you know, I'm like a broke kid from the middle of the country and like photography, like let me do all kinds of stuff.
Got to see the world.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And even before it was like, well, my parents moved to Arkansas. I stayed in Oklahoma for a year going to school. And then I moved back in with my parents my senior year of high school. I was the only skateboarder in town, but I worked at this bluegrass radio station in high school. I worked the last shift. It was kind of an amazing thing. I worked at the grocery store. I worked at my aunt's restaurant. I did a whole bunch of stuff. But then the local radio station was having a contest to hire like a new DJ. And then my dad was like, yeah, you should just go try out. I'm like, okay, whatever. And I went and then they hired me. And so I was supposed to be the country crossover guy. Like to bring in younger people, which like now it's kind of weird because now I'm like, oh yeah, bluegrass is awesome. Like I didn't realize how awesome bluegrass is when I was a kid, but now I'm like, oh yeah, bluegrass is really badass. But I would just read comic books and then try and see how many times I could play a Steve Earle song during the night without my boss calling me going like, play something else. I had like a stupid mullet. I had long bangs. I had like a whole stupid look. Oh, but anyways, my friend Marvin called my boss one day and he's like, hey, I want to make a request for Dude Ranch Dave. And so my boss loved that so much that he totally named the show like Dude Ranch Day.
That's awesome.
But it was appropriate, but it was also like terrible.
You were doing photography back then as well?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So what happened, one of the amazing things is I'm always skateboarding around this tiny little town in Arkansas. Michael, the guy who's a publisher of like the hometown newspaper, he would always like shoot pictures of me for wild art for the thing. And then one day I'm skating curbs at the grocery store, and then I hear the fire department come, and it's like a volunteer fire department, and the house is on fire near there. I kick over there and I'm like standing out in the yard watching it. And they're like unloading all the stuff. And he sees me and he's like, David, there's a camera in the floorboard of the truck. Go get it and take pictures of us. And I was like, yeah, okay, whatever. So then I'm like taking pictures of them. And then the next morning, like a picture that I made is on the front of the newspaper of them like fighting fires or whatever.
Oh, that's cool.
And he was awesome. He's like, you know, you should shoot for the paper all the time. So he gave me like a part-time job and he taught me how to develop film and process print stuff.
You mentioned that like photography was kind of a way for you to gain access to different things that you were interested in. What's your favorite thing or the most impactful thing that you've been able to do because of your photographer that you wouldn't have been able to otherwise?
There's a lot of converging stories here. A lot of my friends have referred to me as the Forrest Gump of photography because I keep sort of stumbling into situations that are really great places to be. And I mean, definitely all through school, a bunch of my friends have said like, oh, David's like the luckiest person that you'll ever meet. And I don't believe in luck at all. I believe.
Sounds like something a lucky person says.
Right. But a lot of good things have happened, but like most of the time they're intentional.
So what kind of things is like the photography used for when you're doing photography for film and TV?
Literally everything, every like kind of social media for the shows, they'll do like marketing where they'll have stories in different magazines. It'll be like, oh, the actor is doing this thing. We need a portrait of them from this thing, or we need a scene from the show. And then sometimes it's the key art that you see. Like I've been working on this show Jigsaw for Netflix, and it's got this guy, Giancarlo Esposito. He was in Better Call Saul. He's in Mandalorian. He's in a ton of stuff. And he's amazing. He's actually like one of the best actors that I've ever, like a real actor that I've ever like been on a show with, because he's really considerate of everyone. And he does an amazing job. But then also there's another actor who you guys actually might be aware of, who starred in Army of Darkness. And I don't want to say his name, but I loved him. I loved him so much. I loved Evil Dead. I loved Army of Darkness. When he had a reboot show that was coming out, the second that I heard about it, I started reaching out to literally everyone that I could think of. Who knows anything about this? How do I work on this show? What's this? You know, I got to make this happen. And then I finally get in touch. It was going to be on Stars. And I wind up getting in touch with the people in the photo department there. And we hit it off like clams. And I am explaining to them how important working on this show is to me. I was like, I didn't even care. They're like, well, they're filming in New Zealand. They're going to film in New Zealand. I go, I will rent an apartment in New Zealand and I will work as a local. I don't care what it takes. I don't care if I just break even. That's enough for me because I want to work on this so bad. And she's like, okay, I have to check with the director. I have to sort of see, because I think that they've already signed a contract with an actual local. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. And it turns out they had. And she's like, I'm really sorry, but if anything happens, like you're the one. But I had previously already called Bourdain and said, hey, if this comes together, I'm going to quit for a while. And then he was like, oh, fuck, I would quit to go to New Zealand and work on that show too. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to see how this goes. But then it didn't happen. And about 6 months later, I'm talking to this person in the photo department. And she's like, David, it's really probably better that you didn't go to New Zealand, because everyone on the show is amazing. But this person, who I don't want to say his name, he's terrible. And I was like, I don't know. I kind of feel like we would hit it off and it would be okay. And then she's like, well, I really think that you dodged a bullet here. And I was like, you know, you say that, but I'm not in New Zealand working on this show right now. But then fast forward like a few years later to last summer, I get a call from Hallmark, which is awesome. I worked on a couple of their shows and they've all been awesome. But they call me and they're like, hey, so we got this show and stars these people. Are you interested? One of them is this person from Army of Darkness and Evil Dead. And I was like, what? Oh my God. Working with him on a Hallmark show seems just weird enough that it will be amazing. And so I go, he is terrible. He's a terrible, terrible person. It hurts my heart so much. It's like literally never meet your heroes because most of the time they're terrible people. Like some stuff happens. For instance, it's a story about two guys who were in a band for like 20 years. They had a bad breakup. And then now, 10 years later, their kids are trying to get them together for a reunion. But they have to make all of these historical photos of like all their albums and stuff. And so like I'm on set one day and then the producer's like, hey, the art director sent you these examples and we need to make this happen. I was like, yeah, okay, totally. No problem. And it's like, if you imagine like Simon and Garfunkel singing into a microphone together or like two guys just standing in a field with tall grass or something, like it's very simple. But so around the set, I look around and I go, yeah, there's like, we could shoot every one of those photos within 100 feet of the building right here. We could do all that. And they're like, okay, that's great. So then I see this actor sitting in a chair over there. Now, part of the problem is this is supposed to be a Christmas film, but it's being shot in the summer. So the actors, you know, they're like, it's hard on them. It's really actually very hard on them. They're wearing like sweaters and coats and stuff. So then they wind up as soon as like, first of all, COVID, everyone's wearing a mask during rehearsal. Normally you can shoot a lot of stuff during rehearsal and like get it out of the way, but they're wearing masks for all of rehearsal. Then the thing starts. And then as soon as the scene ends, everyone's peeling coats off and they got people bringing in fans and like cooling people off. It's really difficult to do anything after that because they've been suffering through this whole scene. But now we have 3 hours where nothing is going to happen. They're building a set. They're like trying to finish a thing. I see this actor sitting in a chair on the side, just playing on his phone, goofing off. Producer comes to me. He goes, hey, can we shoot these photos in the next 2 hours? And I was like, yeah, I can be ready in 10 minutes. And they're like, okay. So they send one of the guys over to tell this actor, hey, here's what we're going to do. And he says, no, I don't want to. Like, we got nothing for 3 hours, bro. Come on, you know. And I'm standing like 25 feet away with this producer and a couple of other people. And this AD went over to talk to him and tell him that. And he comes back and he's like, he said, no. He said, you should shoot the other guy and then you can shoot him later. And I was like, that's stupid because it's going to be dark in a couple hours and I can't shoot him in the dark and him in the daylight. Doesn't make any sense. What is he doing? And then the producer goes, hang on. So then she goes and gets him, talks to him, and then comes back and is like, okay, we're going to do it, but you got to shoot everything on Seamless in here. And I was like, okay, fine. So then they bring in a crew, they put up the Seamless and everything. I do some tests and I talk to them about what they want. And I'm like, okay, that's it. Then the actor comes over and he like walks right up to me and he's like, this isn't how you should do this. This is none of this is me. Like, I'm literally just doing what I'm told. Like, go talk to the producer. Like, I don't have anything to do with this. I'm just doing what I'm told. He's like, you should just shoot, you know, 100 pictures of my face and different angles and whatever. And then you should just Photoshop it on something. I was like, nobody is paying me to Photoshop this together. Like, that's a whole different department. But also, that's on them. If that's how you want them to do it, you have to talk to them because I'm literally just here doing what I'm told. And he's very annoyed through the whole experience. But then when we start shooting, he's amazing. He's like in character. He's doing awesome. He is like totally like doing things. Then as soon as we stop, yeah, next time, you know, you should really do this, right? And I was like, Jesus Christ, I don't have anything to do with this except I'm here. And then this is what's happening. So then we're in some scenes where there's like a recording booth. And he's like supposed to be like doing this part into the microphone and the guys on the other side of his glass are like recording it. And there are two video cameras. There's like a little bitty space in between it, which is where I'm leaning in to shoot. And I am I'm a stone. I'm a statue. I'm like imperceivable in this thing. He does one and he's like, stills, can you sit this one out? Yeah. Okay. He said, yeah, my peripheral vision is like, I got good peripheral vision. Yeah, you know, you're a little distracted. Like, whatever. Yeah. Fuck. I don't care. So then I peace out. And then he did that literally every scene, every time that I'd be around. He's like, yeah, can you sit this way? Can you, don't be in my eye line. And I'm like, okay. So then I'm like looking at the script. And I was like, he talks to like five people in this scene. There's not a place where there's not an eye line. So I'm like shooting behind him. I'm then talking to the network and I go, yeah, I'm having a really hard time with this. I'm not getting anything good with him. And I don't really know how to solve that. And so then I'm talking to a couple of producers. I'm like, I don't know what to do. And then I wind up Googling him. I'm just reading a ton of shit. I find a tweet where he says, if I could be on a deserted island with one person, who would it be? He's like, it would be Anthony Bourdain. I was like, fuck. Oh, I hate to like call this. This is my last ditch effort. So at the end of the day, sitting in a chair in the back, and I go in, I'm like, hey man, can I tell you a story? And he's like, yeah, what do you got? I go, I was talking to Anthony Bourdain about you. And he's like, what? And then the producer's like, oh yeah, David and Tony are friends. He worked for him for years. And he's like, oh, really? I go, yeah. So I was trying to be the photographer on your TV show and it was going well. And I told Tony, man, I'm going to quit to go work on your TV show. And he's like, oh, fuck, I would quit to go work on that in New Zealand too. He's like, are you kidding me? I was like, no, I'm not kidding you. Like, I just wanted you to know. And he's like, that's like the best story. That's amazing. And I was like, okay, great. All right. I just wanted you to know. So then I leave and the producer's like, holy shit, you must be really desperate to like throw that out there. And I was like, yeah, man, I don't want to fucking talk to this dude about anything, but like, this is my only chance to like win him over. So then I'm gone for like 3 days. I come back to set and I'm like, okay, he's totally going to be stoked to have me around now. It'll be totally good. And he's not on the call sheet. I was like, oh, okay, that's weird. Then the next day I come back, he's not on the call sheet too. So I go to the producer, I go, hey, when is he going to be back? I'm like, oh, no. The last day that you were here, that was his last day on set. Fuck. Ah! So it's like the super drag because I don't want my early memories of him to be damaged because I also know that like young him is not current day him. Like when I think about what they did, Make Evil Dead is awesome. Like that's like the sort of stuff that I dream about. Just some guys who are like, yeah, we're going to fucking do our own thing and it's going to be awesome. And we're going to figure it out even though we don't know what we're doing. And it was great. He loved to like talk about that stuff too, which was awesome to get that. But you meet him like 35 years later and he is not the same dude. He's don't want to do that. Jesus Christ. I'm here. I'm like one of like three guys on this set who is so stoked to be here.
Yeah, that's rough and all, because like I always hear like he's such a fan favorite, and I'm assuming it's the person I believe you're talking of, but like
his name's Bruce Campbell.
Yeah. And so like you always hear like awesome stories about him and all, and that's so shitty. Like it almost taints it for me as like just like hearing that like secondhand and all, because like he's such a goofy guy, and I always heard like he loves his fans and shit.
I literally love him in everything that he does.
Yeah he's so good.
He was even in Doctor Strange.
Right. It's like the sort of thing that just makes me go like, oh, please never get a job with Jack Black. Never get one, because I don't want to feel that way. I just want to like love him every day.
Have you, you don't have to name names. Have you had that with other people you admired? Like where you kind of just
meet on set? No, he's the only one.
Okay, that's good.
The opposite is The Rock.
Okay.
In my opinion, deserves to be the biggest star in the world. I did this thing in Florida, actually, where he was producing a TV show and I was there for this like thing. And I was supposed to make a few pictures of him one morning before they started all the promo stuff for it. And we're in this hotel. We have like a little conference room thing with just like a simple backdrop set up and everything. And then I have all like the mood board of what I'm supposed to show him. And then his cousin comes in. He's got, a bunch of cousins and they all kind of work for him. And his cousin comes in like carrying these two giant dumbbells, like sets them down. He's like, hey, Dwayne will be here in a little bit. Is there anything you guys need? Like, no, we're totally good, man. We're just here. Whenever he gets here, it's totally fine. It's the only thing we're here for. And then 10 minutes later, he comes in. He's like got a button up shirt on and he like looks incredible. And then he introduces himself and then he's like, okay, what do we need to do here today? And so then I'm showing him the pictures and I go, okay, this is real simple. Like, this is sort of it. And he's like, okay, can you give me 10 minutes? I'm like, yeah, man, whatever you need, whatever, you know, we're here for you, whatever. And he's like, okay, takes his like button up shirt off, folds it, lays it on the thing, and goes over and picks up the dumbbells. And it's just like, he's just getting totally like ripped, like totally shredded. And we're just like, holy shit, like this guy is amazing. It's like so awesome. And then he gets in front of the camera and he's like instantly like on, he does everything. We shoot, you know, a few minutes, and then we're like looking at the photos, and he's like, showing, he's like, okay, this is really good. Okay, this is good. Like, I don't like that. Let me show you the ones I like. And we like mark the ones, and then he goes, can we shoot a few more? Jesus Christ. Yeah, man, whatever you want to do. I'm totally stoked to shoot the rat. Let's do this. He's like, okay, can you give me 5 minutes? Yeah, man, whatever you need. And he goes over to the dumbbells again. Argh! It's like totally like, you know, like shredded and pumped. And then I'm like talking to his cousin, like while we're there waiting. I was like, yeah, is it always like this? And he's like, yeah, man, Dwayne is, he always wants to be 100%. Yeah, okay, that's awesome. And then he like does it again. He like shows, yeah, these are perfect. This rules. This is great. So then I like turn the pictures in like a couple of weeks later, and I'm walking past the room where the digital tech's like working on the pictures, the retoucher, and he's like smoothing out some of his like veins and stuff. And I was like, no, no, you can't do that. He's like, what? Well, no, these are the instructions I got. No. He worked so hard to make that happen. None of us are ever going to work again. And he might kill us if you do that. And so then I go to the art director and I tell him, I go, look, this is how this went down. Like, yeah, that's no good. And he's like, oh shit. Okay. All right. So he goes in and talks to him. When I come back through later, everything's like super defined and super ripped. I was like, oh, thank the Lord. Like this is, he's the best, man.
That's awesome.
You said he introduced himself to you. How does he introduce himself? Is he like, hi, I'm Dwayne, or is like, hi, I'm the Rock?
Yeah, it's Dwayne. Yeah, he's very like, comes in. He came in, I don't know where he was before, came in by himself, just walks up, his cousin's there, like, you know, leans over, and he's like, you know, he's a big dude, I'm not a big dude, shakes your hand, he's like, hi, I'm Dwayne. Okay, well, what do we need to do today, guys? What do you guys need? He was just super awesome.
That's awesome.
Like,
that's so cool.
Yeah, and then even when like he was like done, he's like, okay, is there anything else that you guys need? Is there anything else we need to do? And we're just like, no, man, that was like way more than we expected at all. Like,
that's awesome.
He's great. He's super great. I think he's the best. And anyone who says anything different, those are fighting words.
When you're on set, like, do they give you like stuff they're looking for? Like your stills, like they're like, hey, we have to hit like a certain thing or like a certain scene. Like, what kind of direction are you actually given?
So on the scripted stuff, on like the other stuff, like before, like Parts Unknown and like all the other stuff, nobody really gives you any direction. I came from this like photojournalism background, a super amazing transition to just go in, be invisible, shoot whatever you want, make, you know, something interesting that they might use that they aren't expecting. But when you're working on scripted stuff, there's like either a photo producer or a publicist who's reading the script and like highlighting some things, going like, oh, this is a good scene, figure out. They want some, you have to shoot some stuff that's evergreen that they can maybe use in other ways that they aren't necessarily expecting. But then they also like don't want you to give away any of the plot in something when you're shooting it. If the killer's got the gun pointed at something, like they want you to shoot that, but it's not going to go in any of the marketing stuff until like a year later or something, or they'll find some way to make it. They don't want you to solve the mystery right away. But, you know, they tell you, oh, we need pull aside portraits of like, you know, these two actors, like try and get them because they're not there for the gallery days. The galleries are like when they come in and shoot portraits of everyone, you know, they're like, yeah, just make something cool of them offset or whatever. It's totally good. The thing that I mostly like is, dude, the sets are amazing. You guys wait till you see this show, Jigsaw. It's amazing. I'm still like trying to wrap my head around like how this all works, because I'm used to just going out into the world. And then now you go into a building, it looks creeper kidnapping building or whatever. And then you go inside and they built this like remarkable thing. You know, from the outside, it looks like a weird construction set. But then you go inside and you're like, oh, this is Hollywood.
Fear magic.
The magic.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, I worked on this show last summer with some of the stuntmen who were working on like the new Spider-Man, mm-hmm. which they shot in Atlanta. And they're showing me videos and stuff of like that setup. And it's the same thing as like the Mandalorian thing. They built these like street sections, which are things from my neighborhood. But then there are no buildings. Just it's a giant digital screen around the whole thing. It's like 30 foot tall, like all LEDs. When I saw that stuff, I was like, they are never filming another superhero film in New York. They never will do it. It makes me so sad, actually. But
and they're quick with those sets too. Like they're able to do a lot more with it. They're able to power out. Like I mean, you even do Mandalorian. Like they did all that in like a year, which is kind of mind-boggling.
You said there was a digital screen. I didn't quite understand what you meant by that.
It's just like if you imagine, you know how they might put a green screen up behind something like this. They have like a digital screen that got like smooth curves around the corners and stuff, and it goes 75% away of the way around the set. And then they'll just project a New York building, like a street scene or something, that'll just be the background. Cause you know, the actors will be in the foreground and the background might be out of focus, but it's Astor Place in New York.
It's like a live green screen almost.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really cool.
If you see, you can like Google some of those, you know, BTS things from Mandalorian, and it's nuts because you just see him. I think that they had some like real problems with it because they did green screen tests, but the armor is like just super reflective. It's just like, I don't know, like we're getting green everywhere. I don't know really how this is going to work. So they did some tests and stuff. They had to move him further away from like the backdrop, but I think the LED walls worked a lot better. But you'll see it just like him standing in a giant space with like a big empty stage around it with like nothing on it. But then they show that scene, you know, they might have like a ramp coming down, but then the ramp will be like all painted green also. And then you'll see it in the thing and he's like walking down some corridor. It's amazing. Yeah. Like technology is so nuts.
I mean, even speaking of technology, like how has technology kind of changed what you've done over the years? I mean, are you still using like real film or is it all digital? I mean,
no, it's all digital. It's all digital. And that's happened really. Digital photography sort of happened in 2001. It's like when it became like a sort of viable thing. I used to have this like stupid camera, the Nikon NC2000E. It had like a big hard drive on the bottom of it. It was like definitely like 14 inches tall. You put a big lens on it. And I remember as like a stupid kid, I was like so excited. I was like working for like the big newspaper, you know, in Fort Smith, Arkansas. And I would show up to the basketball games with this giant thing. Now I look at those pictures. It's terrible. The quality is terrible. Everything about it was terrible.
Does your son travel with you when you travel about?
He did. He has flown. I'd have to check. I think he's flown 84 times, but he hasn't for a while. I mean, he's flown a few times. We did a big Europe trip and we did some other stuff. But for a while, I was like a nervous dad and I wouldn't go anywhere without him. And then, you know, he's like when he got into school and like was doing stuff sort of more regularly, like his mom was like, no, you can't just take him because he's got responsibilities and like he needs to like to
moms
and like whatever. But then I wound up I went to Iraq several times before him. When he was born, I went one time and it was the first time in my life I'd ever been nervous. The whole time I was like, what am I doing here? I'm going to die. And my son is going to like, who's going to take care of my son? And like, it was a terrible, terrible experience the whole time. So then I just counted down the days until I got back. And I was like, this mindset is no way for me to be here. It's not safe for me to feel like this and be here. It just like, it won't work out. And so then like, I came back and I was like, okay, I don't do that anymore. I don't know what I do now, but I don't do that.
I'm interested in your comedy. I'm a huge comedy fan. Wait, how long have you been doing that?
I don't know. Tony died in 2008. I mean, I've been doing stupid stuff for a long time. One of the things that I've done, I sort of always like have made the comment to critical photographers that this photography thing is my day job because I want to be a comedian.
Oh, really?
Not even a comedian, really. Like, I don't really want to do stand-up. But like, I like to write funny. I'm not a performer really, but I love it. I think it's like the most important. A bunch of the other parents are also like, oh yeah, you're like the one parent in New York City who would be so stoked if their son decided to be a comedian. You'd be like, yeah, let's do it. We're in. How can I help?
Through doing this podcast, you know, like we've talked to a lot of comedians. I've started like writing a little bit too. It's just kind of, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I found like the thing that I have to like be better at is the thing that like helped was just sort of editing, because I ramble too much. Mm-hmm. And so I've gotten really good at writing jokes where the jokes are really set up punchline. You know, delivering that sort of stuff is like a really good exercise, because it, in those instances where I'm like, okay, so I'm going to write this skit and here's what's going to happen. Set up punchline, boom. And that's really what TikTok is, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very, very, I mean, you got like 10 seconds of attention spans on TikTok. So
even less than that, like we look at our like the metrics for our videos, you know, it's like 2 or 3 seconds. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like we got to reel them in right away.
Yeah. Sex. But like, let's actually talk. Let me see. I made a note that I want to talk about some like real like inspiration, like sort of where things come from.
Okay.
Yeah, man, definitely.
So I told you guys, like, one of the things after Tony died, it's like, I was like, oh yeah, I need to like figure out comedy. I want to like figure out what this is. And New York is like the best place in the world for that. Mm-hmm. Because pre-COVID, you could go to comedy shows. You go to like 3 or 4 shows a night.
Oh yeah.
They're so amazing. And I was going to stuff all the time. So I have a friend who is a comedian in LA, and she's amazing. And she has like a fundraiser that she does every year. And I was in DC speaking at something. And then I got this text from some people like, oh my God, you guys are both in town to, you know, at the same time. You got to like get together. And I hadn't seen her in like 20 years. So I'm like, oh yeah, definitely. That'll be awesome. Text her. I go, look, I'm not in town. Actually, I'm going to be back tomorrow. She's like, oh, come to the show. We're going to be doing a show. And I was like, okay, great. So I go over, my friend's name is Rebecca Corey. She's hilarious. And I go to the show at the Gotham Comedy Club, which somehow I had never been in, but it's way bigger than I had imagined that it was. But I go in and Wyatt Cenac is on stage, and I'm like, oh shit, he's really funny. Like this is good. She's like, oh, do you know Wyatt? Wyatt and I have been friends since we were 14. And I was like, oh shit. Okay. No, I don't know Wyatt, but like I've seen him around. I used to work on Billy on the Street, and Wyatt was one of the guys we would run into all the time. I don't know. He lived over by 23rd Street or something, but like we would constantly just run into him on the street. So then she introduced me to this other woman who is named Katie Rich, and she is a writer for SNL. And I knew of her because she wrote one of the best tweets that I had ever read. And she got suspended from SNL because of it. And the tweet was something about, she had said that Barron Trump was going to be the first homeschool shooter.
I remember that. Yeah.
So amazing. But she had like just written that. And when she told me, I was like, oh, fuck, I know her. She's great. And she's like, oh my God, do you know David? David is hilarious. You know, you're going to love him. I was like, oh, I don't think you should say that here. This is not the room for you to say that I'm funny. And she's like, oh my God, wait, do you want to do a set tonight? And I had been at this photo thing for the weekend, and I hadn't really slept at all. So then I'm like trying to like go through, I'm like, okay, what bits do I have that I could do? I don't really know what I have. It's funny. And I turn around and John Mulaney's sitting behind me, and he's going to go on next. And I was like, oh fuck. I go, look, I want to do this really bad, and I don't mind bombing at all, but I don't want to be the one to bomb at your show, because like this is a fundraiser. And she's like, no, it's totally fine. We do multiple of these every year. And she's like, you can come on anytime that you want. I was like, okay, I'm going to polish a set and then I'll like do it. So then I go to the Pit, one of the places here, and I take a stand-up class, a writing class. And I'm working on it with some people. And it's kind of awesome. Chris Griggs, the guy who was teaching a class there, it's all stuff that you know, but sort of helps you figure it out. But we were writing jokes. And then I realized I had a habit of just writing jokes that were just jokes. Like anyone could say them and they're not that important at all. But he was like really pushing me, like, no, you got to write about the stuff that, you know, only you can write about. So then I wrote a whole set where all my jokes were about suicide and cancer. And still it's like the best stuff in the world. So I was like, okay, I totally got a set that I'm going to like do. I'm going to fucking ruin everyone's night, but this is going to be great. And then COVID happened. And so it's been a little bit on hold, but I did a couple of times here. And it was amazing because it was obvious that the jokes are mine. But then people, you can see that thing where there's a lot of groaners where people like want to laugh, but they're also like, I feel like a bad person if I laugh about that. Both of my parents died last year from cancer, and my dad had been sick. They've both been sick forever. And I had, it's so nuts. I had 21 people in my life who all had cancer simultaneously.
Oh, wow.
And so I was on the phone with most of them every day. And not everyone is this way, but like most of them, my parents were not this way. But my friends, they like make fun of it all the fucking time. And it, so it's really like kind of good. You know, you'd tell there'd be people who'd come up after a couple of shows and be like, oh my God, like my best friend died of cancer last year. He would love that. It's like, yeah, I totally get it. So with the jokes about Tony, like I wound up like writing them and then I was like, oh shit, I need to figure out if Tony's wife is going to hate this. I need to figure out who is going to, like some people are definitely going to hate this. And so then I like started asking like other friends and stuff on the crew. And they're like, well, the only thing you have to ask yourself is, would Tony think it's funny? And I was like, oh, fuck, yeah. I can do every one of these jokes because he fucking loved dark, painful stuff. So from that felt like it's not only okay, but it's necessary to find your voice. Like I can write funny stuff if I want, it's no problem, but I want to tell things that actually make me happy. And I really think that the world is like bending for better or worse towards that. If you look at shows like The Boys, or if you look at literally every great animated show, dude, the shit is uncomfortable and funny and a little bit offensive sometimes. Like literally my family will tell you, as soon as everyone else goes to bed, I'm just turning on animated TV. And I did this thing. I worked on this show, a Larry King show that had Seth MacFarlane, Jack Dorsey from Twitter, Shaq, Conan O'Brien, fucking Russell Brand, and they were going to have dinner together. So we're like hanging out at Larry King's house and I'm talking to Seth MacFarlane. I was like, I don't know. You seem a little more reserved. Like what gives? Cause I think you're the funniest dude here. And he's like, oh no, 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 no. He's like, Conan is the funniest dude here. And he's like, the thing is you have, you know, read your room. He's like, I can find where my place is. And like, I don't sort of need to do it. And I had this real, wasn't a grudge. I just was basically, anytime you guys hear me talk shit about something, if you just fast forward a little bit, then you're going to see me with my foot in my mouth going like, oh, you guys know, I didn't understand that at all. I didn't know what was really happening. I worked at this like comedy festival called Just for Laughs in Chicago. And it was amazing. All my favorite comedians were there. You're hanging out with all these guys. And basically, I found out that everyone that I love had worked for Conan O'Brien at some point. And I was like, well, whatever. He's not that funny. And they're like, oh, no, he's like the best. And I was like, no, I don't believe it. All of my favorite comedians write for him. Of course, he's going to be funny because he's doing their jokes. And he's like, no, 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 no. He creates an environment where everybody can shine on every level. He's like, you can't imagine all the shit that I've learned from this guy. And I was like, whatever, whatever. I totally didn't believe it. But then when I saw him in person, like, first of all, like Russell Brand is kind of a lunatic. Like, like maybe for real, we're doing something and I'm like standing off on the side and they're doing this thing and they have like a little break and he's like, oh, I'm going to go to the loo, whatever. And he gets up, he walks by, he sees me and he's like, come here. And I was like, oh fuck. Okay. Well, what's going on? And we were walking. I go, dude, the bathroom's over there. And he's like, come on. And we go upstairs in Larry King's house and he's like looking for Larry King's bedroom. And then he goes into the bedroom and I'm like, oh fuck. I don't know what I'm supposed to do right now. Cause he's like, and he like starts rummaging through everything. And then he like comes back. He's like, all right, we're ready. And then he goes back downstairs and they've already started filming again. So he comes in and like, oh, la, 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 I'm back from the loo, whatever. And sits down and does his thing. And every time that Larry King would try and, you know, engage him or whatever, he would like redirect it and talk about some crazy shit. Larry King could not manage him at all. So he's like asking him some stuff and trying to ask him something serious. I was like, that's interesting, Larry. But what I want to ask you is, why is your lovely wife wearing knickers like this? And then out of his pants, he pulls Larry King's wife's underwear out. And they're all like, what the fuck is this? Oh, Jesus. But Conan was so magical in the way that he could redirect every single person. It was like if Russell Brand is a lion, he was like a crazy lion tamer. I'm going to make you say funny things, but I'm going to direct it. And, you know, he would just get everyone back on target. And so then like, after I saw him, I was like, oh shit, like that guy's like got a line for everything. he is actually like way better than I would ever give him credit for, because I never watched his show. And then I also, I wound up working on his show, shooting some BTS stuff one time. And I'm like walking around in the studio, like during rehearsals or whatever. He's on stage and with some other people. He's like, hey, hey, gets on the microphone. Hey, in the back. What? Yeah, you. Who are you? I was like, Jesus Christ. How did, like, there's 50 people in here. How does he know that I'm like the new guy? But he does. So then I go up, I go, yeah, I'm David. I worked at Turner. I'm like here. I worked on that Larry King show with you. He's like, oh yeah. Oh, that show was a total mess. I was like, yeah, it was like pretty wild, right? And then he was amazing. But then I started watching his stuff and I'm like, oh crap, he's really smart. He's really like, and when I started like trying to figure out how people like write jokes or write comedy, I also was never into Seinfeld.
The show or just like the stand-up?
Both. Yeah. I didn't give the stand-up very much time because I didn't care for the show. Yeah. You know, you sort of see the stuff, but then you see there was a series where like him and Chris Rock and a couple of other people are talking about how they make jokes or how they like tell stories or whatever. And everyone in that show is amazing. But then Seinfeld is just smarter than all of them. Everything that he does is so intentional. And, you know, there's like, you guys know Judah Friedlander?
Yeah.
So he's like, he was on 30 Rock. He was like one of the writers, but he's like a East Village guy. He plays in town. When he's in town, he's playing somewhere every night. His deal is he does crowd work. I'd see him like in Tompkins where they found the shooter. I would see him in Tompkins all the time. Was walking through, looks like a crazy homeless person. And he always pulls a little bitty suitcase, a little rolling suitcase with him wherever he's at. And you're like, oh man, he just looks like, in a park full of crazy people, he like looks like the most crazy person. And I wound up working on a show with him, with one of the SNL people. I'm talking to him because I'd read a story that during the peak of 30 Rock, that he was like sleeping on a friend's couch for like 9 months in our neighborhood. And I was like, hey, is that story true? I heard you like slept on your friend's couch like at like your biggest. I heard you slept over there for like 9 months. He's like, oh, no. I stayed at his house for like a year and a half. And I was like, why didn't you buy an apartment? Oh, no. Real estate in New York is terrible investment. It's a terrible idea, like too expensive. It's a bad idea. And I was like, I don't know. You're like one of the people who could buy something here. So I don't know why it's a bad idea. And I go, well, where do you live? You live in Brooklyn? He's like, no, I usually stay in Queens. And I was like, in Queens? Jesus Christ. Turns out what happens is when he's performing, when he's touring, he's like, they always put you up. So you stay in a, you know, hotel there. He's like, I'm gone a lot. So why would I want to pay rent in New York? Because it's ridiculous. Or why would I want to pay for anything here? I was like, okay, but where do you stay? And he's like, I stay in these motels in Queens. And he stays in these $50 a night motels. This is not a joke. This is so nuts. He's like, yeah. And I go, well, what about your stuff? He goes, well, it's all right there. And he points to the little suitcase, which is sitting against the wall on the thing. And I was like, no, it's not. And he goes and opens it up. He's got like two or three little hats in there. He's got some t-shirts and some pants. And I was like, holy crap, for real? And he's like, yeah, why would I ever want to live here? Why would I ever want to pay for anything here? I was like, because you live here. I see you all the time. And I went and saw that dude. He's so good. I probably saw him like 12 times in a row. And his crowd work is phenomenal. And so then I was like trying to figure out, okay, what is crowd work? I'm not really a crowd work person, but like when you see it work, you're like, oh crap, these people are geniuses. They're so good. I thought he was the best one. I was like, out of everyone I've seen in the city, I was like, I've seen this dude like a dozen times. I think he's like the best one. But then one night I saw him at a club where he was like the fourth person to go on. And he was like at a different show because he'd do like four shows a night. And he just came in and went right up on stage, like right when it happened. But he didn't know that the three people before him all also did all crowd work. And so everyone knew everything about everyone in the room. Nobody knew anything. And so he came and it was like the first time I'd ever seen him bomb. And I was like, oh shit, it's obvious now that he's trying all the same things. But I was like, if he would have known, if he would have seen their sets, then I know that he would have like steered it in a different way, but he didn't. So then I was like, oh fuck, even the good guys can bomb. I'm fucking not afraid of bombing. I'll do it all the time.
All right, Dave, before you leave, though, we do ask one last question of our guest. Yeah. Any words of wisdom for anyone aspiring to get into the industry? That's something you wish you would have got when you first started out?
Oh, man, there's like a ton of stuff. The thing that I believe, like right now, the industry is, I was really fortunate that I had a lot of serendipity and a lot of people who were willing to like steer me in one way or another or provide some sort of opportunities. But I think if I was doing it today, the thing that I believe is most important is persistence, because I see people all the time who are like, yeah, I want to do this. But then when things aren't easy, like kind of peace out and just like, no, you're really good. You're like almost there. You just gotta. And then a couple of friends who've sort of done it and then realized like, oh, it's like still waves. Like sometimes it's massive and sometimes it's terrible. I think persistence is like the key, man. Just if you really want to do it, it's that idea. Like, would you do this, you know, if it wasn't an occupation? Would you do this if you had other options? I feel like a lot of people who are really good at this, you know, they don't really feel like they have other options. They're like, no, I'm going to do this Tony Hawk style. I'm going to do this till the wheels fall off.
Great documentary.
Yeah.
We actually, last week, we had the guy that did all the music, the composer for that
documentary
on our show. Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah, really cool guy. Yeah.
Yeah, dude, it's so good. The other thing, so persistence, and you have to trust in your own vision. You know, it's fine to emulate people like until you learn from that, but then you have to stop and you have to understand what your vision is. When I first moved to DC, I did a bunch of stupid things. Like goofy things, but they were all lessons that I was teaching myself because I didn't grow up around other photographers. But I did a couple of things where I would like, in DC, it was the first time I was in a place where there are a lot of photographers who would be covering the same things. And what I would do was I would walk into a room and I would go, who is the best photographer in the room? And then I would try and stand by them. I would like, okay, what lens is she using? Like you can listen to it. You can go like, okay, what shutter speed is that? Okay. All right. You can listen when stuff's happening. You can listen to like when they're shooting. And I was really fortunate that I had a couple of friends at the Washington Post who were editors. One of my early mentors, like let me hang out there. I'd like hang out at the light and the light room, the light table all the time. And then I would watch people edit stuff. So I would see photographers that I would been like, I'd get to see their edits and then I'd go, oh, my stuff is garbage or whatever. But then there was one photographer who 3 days in a row, first day I see him, I was like, oh, shit, he's really good. And I would like go hang out by him, kind of watch him. Then the next day I was at a thing that he was at again. And I'm like standing by him and we just start talking. I go, oh, so this is the thing. I'm trying to teach myself how to be a photographer. And so I've got a theory because I've had several theories that have failed. But my current theory is this theory. I try and roll into a room and figure out who the best photographer is and then just get near them and figure out what they're doing to try and emulate it. He's like, no, that's not a bad idea. It's pretty good. And so then he was real open with like, yeah, here's what I'm shooting. This is like, you know, this is my idea when this is happening. Then stuff would happen. It was really good. And then he was very helpful. Then the next day I wound up at another thing with him and it was like police were going to raid this house and they make a stand behind this like armored vehicle until they've cleared the thing and then we can go in. And so when they go in, we both start shooting. And then every time I shoot, he goes, nope, shoot, nope, nope. Let's shoot again. That's your shot. Nope, nope. That's a good one. And then I like went back and edited the photos. And when I was looking through the thing, I was like, holy shit. Oh, he's totally right. All these edits, he just edited my photos. These are perfect. And I found like, that when I was like open about that stuff, that like, here's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to be better. I'm trying to like learn. People were like, not only willing, but people were like excited to be involved. They were like excited to help. Yeah, I'll contribute to your education. Find people, be open, tell people what you need. Not everyone will want to help, but some people will want to help. And then also pass it down when you find some other people.
And most of the successful people, like no matter what industry, that they usually want a mentor. They want to help someone else out. There's a good book called The Go-Giver. It really specifies that, where being open and helping other people kind of helps you more in the long run as well as building those connections. And also, I really find it's important.
Yeah, right on.
David, it's been an absolute blast to have you on the podcast.
It was great meeting you, man.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Where can our listeners find more of you and your work at, though?
Oh, geez. So I have, if you look up, there's nothing on the Emu command yet, but the Emu command is where all of my videos are going to go. I've got a video thing that I'm working on right now. And so, but just look on my Instagram at David Scott Holloway. That's like the best place. Email me. I got a website, davidscottholloway.com. Send me email and, you know, I'll put you on a mailing list and send you the stuff. Because the videos are actually the thing that I'm excited about. They're going to be goofy. You're going to be like, Jesus Christ, this is how he spends his time. But I try to think about, I have all this family and friends and stuff who don't live in New York and who might never come to New York. And my existence here is very foreign to them. So a lot of times, like, I want to make some things that definitely speak from my voice, but explain like what my experience is.
Looking forward
is.
To it.
And some dick
right
pics.
On.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. You guys send me your numbers. I'm going to definitely send you a few. When you least expect it, you're going to just get one. You're going to feel the buzz. Like, oh, what's that? Oh, Jesus Christ.
David again.
Yeah, he's good. I liked him.
I absolutely adore him. Like, I think he's
awesome. His stories are really long, but then like they would come to these like really insightful resolutions. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, no, he did say from the very beginning he was a rambler. And I always say that with like a grand slam, like, yeah, sure, whatever, everyone's a rambler. But like, all right, man, yep, you I think you beat Deeza. Like,
yeah.
Oh, man. But no, he's really cool. Like, there's... I wish I had more time. I know.
Yeah, me too. There's so many things. I mean, the fucking like he just was like, yeah, my great uncle started this cult in 1939. I was like, what? And like,
so you focus on the awesome. Weird shit.
And then, you know, like he mentioned, I mean, you know, all the stuff with Bourdain, we didn't get into a lot of that. There's so many cool things that he mentioned he worked on.
Yeah.
You know, like
I do like that he comes from more like humble beginnings.
Yeah.
Like that, definitely that. And then even like personality wise, like just growing up as like a skateboarder that like punk music and you know, like going, being able to travel around the world and see all these cool things and document and work with like awesome talent. Like the talent he's worked with is absolutely insane. Like just.
Yeah. I wasn't expecting a Dwayne The Rock Johnson story. Yeah. That was pretty sweet. Or Bruce Campbell.
Yeah, the Campbell story is pretty good. Yeah,
hey, that's awesome. After a while, we're gonna have like a super cut of people just like shitting on celebrities.
I mean, he didn't really shit on them. No, it was no Jim Wise or
anything. No, he didn't. Like even when he talked about it, he didn't come out all that bad in the story. So
no, I mean it was pretty tame for Hollywood people. I don't know, like Bruce Campbell. Like I always heard like not like a pedestal, but like. Just I've always heard like he's such like a he just adores his fans and all he goes out of his way for like fan service and shit.
Mm-hmm.
And like he was saying like he's gotten really lucky and I think that's one of those like things like not a lot of people talk about luck and like what an important role it plays in a lot of like these type of industries. I think luck is very important and being at the right place at the right time and especially with photography like getting a lot of those like shots like he said he would be kind of like a ghost and all just catching moments and stuff. Like
you have to be at the right place at the right time, but you also have to have the right set of skills. And I think it seems like photography is something everybody's looking for.
Yeah.
So, it's all of that. You know, we have no idea like how many opportunities we're missing by not having a particular set of skills, you know,
or even being in the right place at the right time. You might have all the skills in the world. There's lots of really, really good creative people and they're just never given the opportunity or if they're just never.
Yeah. A lot of them, I don't think they understand how to find opportunities either.
No, it's sometimes like other stuff. Like they don't market themselves well or they get a bad
rap.
That's
what I'm saying. Okay. Like it's hard though. Like people who have been lucky and they, you know, when they talk about why they've been successful, it's about, they usually talk about these things like hard work and, and, you know, putting the right work in and like, you know, eventually someone will see you. I think that's probably true, effectively true for a lot of people, but you have to be in the right place. You have to be like, if you're in New York or LA, it's probably more likely that you'll get seen, but sometimes not, if there's nothing about you that pops in those places, you know, like it might even be better to be in a place where there's less people around and then you can gain following that way.
And sometimes there's just people that just, they never really get discovered or noticed and all, like there's more of a cult type thing, which is fine as well.
I like that there's a lot more, I mean, we've talked about this a lot, but you know, there's a lot of opportunities for people to the environment is ripe for people making their own opportunities and developing their own audiences.
Yeah, especially in this day and age. It's definitely very, very doable.
That's really cool. Thank you all for listening. If you would like to support the WWSD podcast, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/WWSD_podcast. Make sure you like and subscribe on our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
So it's good. I like magic.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. You guys play D&D?
No, we actually play Magic, the card game.
Oh. Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah. You look like you play D&D. I play D&D. Oh, I don't play Magic, though. Yeah.
Were you an old school D&D player, or did you get into it as you got older?
Yeah. Like, I played since I was 14,